Last year, candidate Obama promised a future with jobs for all, but not any kind of jobs.
My presidency will mark a new chapter in America's leadership on climate change that will strengthen our security and create millions of new jobs in the process.
Green jobs. Wind farms, hybrid battery plants, geothermal, solar panel production, advanced biofuels, all opportunities for good, steady work.
I love my job. He loves his job.
$60 billion in stimulus money was set aside for green jobs. The question is, how many jobs and how green? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 27th. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And coming up, Celeste, we're also going to look at contaminants in your walls. Chinese drywall is the latest U.S.-China trade dispute. And a listener has a bankruptcy story that's more than a cautionary tale. And retraining sounds like a good idea, but what does it take when you go back to school in a recession?
But first, Andrew Eder joins us. Andrew is a business reporter for the News Journal in Wilmington, Delaware. Andrew, we're talking about green jobs today. And in just a few hours, Vice President Joe Biden is going to a closed General Motors plant in Wilmington, and he's expected to announce the plant's going to be reopened for building hybrid electric cars. So what's the unemployment rate in Wilmington, Delaware right now, Andrew?
The unemployment rate is 13%.
13%. And how many jobs are they expecting to be created at this this Fisker Auto plant?
Well, we're waiting to hear, but we're expecting 2,000 or more if all goes according to the company's plans.
And according to what you've talked to around people in Wilmington, what's more important here, the green or the job?
Oh, I don't think people here care about what color the jobs are. They just want jobs.
Okay, Andrew Eder, stay with us. We're going to talk with you more about green jobs in just a few moments.
And in the headlines, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid now has to convince moderate Democrats to support his health care bill. It's headed to the Senate floor with a public option that would let states opt out. But the GOP is doubtful. Here's Senator John Cornyn.
The government plan would not be just a competitor. It would, in fact, act as a predator.
Cornyn says a government-run insurance program, even with a state opt-out, would hurt private companies.
In Iraq, a group affiliated with al-Qaeda says it's behind the twin suicide bombings that killed more than 150 people, including many children. The group calls itself the Islamic State of Iraq. The Washington Post reports that a former Marine who fought in Iraq has become the first U.S. official to resign in protest over the war in Afghanistan. The Post says Matthew Ho was working for the State Department in Afghanistan when he quit. He says the war is fueling the insurgency. And back home, as we've been hearing, the president talks about clean energy today when he tours a solar power plant in Florida. The markets closed down again yesterday. The Dow is going to open up next hour at 98.68. The S&P will start trade at 10.67. The NASDAQ will begin at 21.42. So our mind today is on your 9-to-5 job, and specifically how your job or your profession may be changing as the economy changes. Are you ready?
Who has a 9-to-5 job anymore?
I certainly don't. Yeah. But you know, John, I went to school for opera, and that's not what I'm doing right now. So I'm wondering how many people had to get retrained for the job that they
planning.
Have.
Good planning. Really good planning there.
I was on scholarship, okay?
We want to hear your retraining stories, though, right here at The Takeaway, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Are you ready for the new economy? John, we're talking about jobs all day today. How jobs are changing, how maybe the economy is changing.
Radio is solid so far. We don't have to retrain, but we might. I mean, people have to retrain and change careers multiple times during their career.
Absolutely. And, you know, radio has not stayed the same. Radio has also become very much an online thing, an interactive thing. Radio has changed, too. One of the new jobs for the new economy is green jobs. And President Obama, as we spoke about earlier, is visiting Arcadia, Florida to visit a solar energy center. He'll give there a speech about green jobs, clean energy. Vice President Joe Biden, as we mentioned, will be in Delaware today. He's going to a GM assembly plant that was closed, but will reopen to make hybrid electric and fully electric cars from a company out of California called Fisker Automotive.
Big campaign issue, but now it's time to deliver.
That's the question. Are they delivering? Joining us to talk about that is Andrew Eder. We spoke to him earlier. He's the business reporter for the News Journal in Wilmington, Delaware. We also have Susan Hoffman, editor of the Arcadian in Arcadia, Florida. And Bracken Hendricks joins us. Bracken is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, also served as advisor to the campaign and transition team of President Barack Obama, and co-author of Apollo's Fire, Igniting America's clean energy economy. Bracken, you also served with President Clinton on his green energy team as well, correct?
That's right. There's a good history here that the Obama administration is building on, but President Obama is really showing a lot of leadership, I think, right now with the speech and by focusing his administration as he is today with, you know, two events simultaneously to really showcase how green means jobs. This is about investment.
Okay. Well, you've been helping to make environmental policy, obviously, for a long time here. And I'm just wondering, to get a few details from you. For example, what constitutes a green job? For this plant that we were talking to Andrew Eder about in Wilmington, Delaware, they're going to make green, quote-unquote, green cars. They're hybrid electric and electric cars. But what about the people who manufacture the parts? Does that constitute a green job, even if they're in a supposedly polluting industry, just because they're manufacturing parts for a green car?
Well, that's, you're asking exactly the right question. We're used to thinking of the environment as sort of something off to the side. And what President Obama is doing here by talking about green jobs is just treating green industries as an emerging sector of the economy. And this is a place where a lot of investment is going to flow if we're going to really roll back global warming. So green jobs, it means new jobs that we'll create. You know, solar panel installers, they didn't exist before. Now we're going to need a whole lot of them to deploy a lot of new solar energy. That's true, but it also means jobs that you save. Automobile manufacturers, there will be a tremendous demand for the skills of auto workers as we try and produce a whole new generation of electric cars, new drivetrains, new propulsion systems. We're transforming those jobs as we save them. So we really need to think of it as a stream of investment.
I'm just wondering, at what point do we stop calling them green jobs? What about the trucker who picks up the cars in Wilmington, Delaware, and trucks them either to the train station or trucks them to California or wherever they're going? Is that a green job because he's hauling green cars?
Well, you know, I think the question you're asking is a really good one. When we think about IT jobs and the way that information technology completely transformed our economy, the very first wave of IT jobs were computer programmers, software designers, people laying fiber optic cable. But that's true. But now, today, a cop on the beat sitting in a squad car is directly doing data entry into an online database through a laptop mounted in his car. His job has been transformed by information technology. What you're talking about is a kind of a deeper transformation that will happen as we have to move the entire economy into a foundation of low-carbon energy. But if you look just specifically at the work of building clean energy, we are going to directly transform electricians and insulators who today are building leaky, inefficient buildings. Their skills and the work that they do every day will be put to use to do the jobs of a green-collar economy. And that worker will move from the current economy, the pollution-based economy, into doing work that's directly related to local investments in reducing carbon emissions and saving energy.
Okay, let's bring Susan Hoffman into the discussion. Susan, you're the editor of The Arcadian in Florida.
Yes, good morning.
And the president is visiting the DeSoto Next Generation Solar Energy Center today, which is going to be the largest photovoltaic plant in the country. But this is a place where we're not talking about ongoing jobs, right? We're talking about a lot of construction jobs up front, and then there's not going to require a lot of people to run this plant.
Exactly. Florida Power and Light estimated about 400 jobs during the building of the facility, but there will be very few jobs required to maintain it or keep it in operation.
So what is the reaction among the people of Arcadia to this?
Well, the people, I think, are excited about the solar plant because it is going to put Arcadia on the map. It will be able to power about 3,000 homes, they estimate. And this is only the first phase. FPL has in mind expanding this plant significantly over the next few years.
That's Florida Power and Light.
So yes, I'm sorry.
Bracken Hendricks, listening to Susan's story and to Andrew Eder's story, that the job is perhaps more important than the green, I think, you know, you've made some great investments, the Obama administration has, in talking about construction, although the amount of energy required to make photovoltaics, I think, exceeds the amount of energy they produce at this point in the technology. But let's talk about transportation for a minute. There are some who say you are making exactly the wrong investment in personal electric transportation when, in fact, the green solution would be to invest in public transit, which the Obama administration hasn't done nationally.
Actually, that's not true. You want to be investing in transforming our cars. I think, you know, people will continue to drive cars, and we need to move from reliance on imported oil to the use of electricity, which cuts carbon emissions 30% even using today's coal-powered electricity. And as we get greener, those electric cars will get consistently greener. But in the Recovery Act, there was about $8.4 billion spent on transit projects.
A tiny pittance, in fact.
Certainly. Well, but about a 70% increase in transit spending. There was about several thousand percent increase in spending on smart grid, and overall about a 300% increase in spending on clean energy. Certainly we're not spending nearly what we need to on transit or rail,
But Bracken, it's about the investment. It's about the big idea. Shifting away from personal transportation is the way to get green, not simply to clean up a few electric cars on the front end of the fleet.
I don't think it's an either or trade-off. We absolutely need to do both. You're absolutely right. What we need is choices. Today, when a consumer wants to get to a store, when a worker wants to get to work, or when you want to take your kid to daycare, you have to get in a car in most places in the country, and you have to burn oil. And what we want is to have choices. We want to have walkable communities. We want to have transit projects. We want to have rail. And when we do get in a car, we want to get in a car that doesn't pollute.
Andrew, let's go low back to you. Andrew Eder is the business reporter for the News Journal in Wilmington, Delaware. And Andrew, this plant that's coming from the Fisker Auto Company, they're building a sedan there. And what? Tell me about these cars. Now, the very first car that I happen to know that Fisker was building cost almost $90,000. What car is this plant expected to produce?
Well, they're building a car. They will build a car, according to the company's plans. That's going to be a more family-oriented sedan. It's going to start retailing at about $48,000. But it's still under development, so we still don't know that, and they're probably not going to start building them until 2012.
Right. It's going to take a while to retrofit this plant to make it possible to create the cars there. So the number of jobs that are coming in, have they said that these are going to be locally sourced jobs, that local people are going to get them?
Well, we're still waiting. The official announcement is today, but yes, by all indications, we have in Delaware in the past year, we have actually had two auto assembly plants close, a Chrysler plant and then this GM plant. So there's certainly a big workforce here that's just waiting to be tapped by this company.
And Susan Hoffman, the editor of the Arcadian, the construction jobs, are those coming from local people around Arcadia to build that solar plant there?
Some of them did, although I understand the company did bring in some skilled labor from other parts of the country who go around the country helping them build these solar plants.
What's the unemployment rate where you are?
The unemployment rate is hovering around 12%.
So 12% in Arcadia, Florida, 13% in Wilmington, Delaware. In Wilmington, Delaware, you won't see a huge number of jobs for a couple years, and in Arcadia, Florida, you're not going to see a huge influx of jobs.
No, we will not.
Bracken, very, very quickly, they're not going to see jobs for a few years. This is delayed help.
Well, she was talking about 400 jobs in construction, a number of them local. When we talk about investing in the kinds of transition that's needed to get to a green-collar economy, you're investing in areas that are growing faster. The number of green jobs has grown by about 9%, mm-hmm. while the jobs broadly have grown about 3%.
Okay.
These are faster-growing areas of the economy.
Okay.
And frankly, those construction jobs are desperately needed. There's over 1.5 million construction workers sitting out of the economy right now.
Okay, Bracken Hendricks is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We also heard from Andrew Eder in Delaware and Susan Hoffman in Florida.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. We'll go to Todd Zwillick first. He's the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. And Todd, big news on healthcare yesterday. Here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid explaining there will indeed be a public option in the Senate healthcare bill.
As we've gone through this process, I've concluded with the support of the White House, Senators Dodd and Baucus, that the best way to move forward is to include a public option with the opt-out provision for states. Under this concept, states will be able to determine whether the public option works well for them and will have the ability to opt out.
So, Todd, there a lot of people are trying to pretend like it didn't happen, but there were a lot of people who said the public option was dead.
Yeah, there were, and most of them were in the Senate, and now it's alive. Although Harry Reid putting it in the bill doesn't mean it's going to get into final legislation. There are a lot of twists and turns and a lot of arms to be twisted before we actually find out if this public option is going to become law. But Harry Reid has made a political calculation, and that political calculation is that his best chance to get to 60 votes in the Senate while still satisfying his Democratic liberal base, which, as you know, Celeste, really, really wants this, is to go with this sort of... In a way, it's a weakened public option. Look, his base wanted a robust public option based on Medicare, national plan, everybody does it. That's not what this is. This is a little weaker.
But it's, I mean, obviously it's disappointing to Olympia Snow, who felt like she'd gone out on a limb for the Democrats to work on a bipartisan, well, bipartisan if that includes one Republican senator, bill. But, you know, when you say it's its Democratic liberal base, when they do polling, it's not just Democratic liberals that support the public option in the public.
Yeah, it's not just Democratic liberals who support it, but it's Democratic liberals who are putting pressure on the blogs, on the phones, on email, on their members of Congress. I don't think
that they have the numbers. They have the numbers.
That's right.
I mean, this all feels very Kabuki-esque to me. I mean, I can hear the headlines, snow out in cold by Democrats. I mean, I just don't think that the public option was ever dead, and the Democrats always had the votes. And the question is 60 or 59 at this point, don't you think?
Well, that may be true. We're going to have to wait and see. And I know that's sort of a truism of politics. But here's the thing. There is one school of thought, which is that Senator Harry Reid is trying to get his members, trying to give them something they can vote for because they think it's a risky vote. Listen to John Kyle, who's the assistant minority leader for the Republicans and the Republican whip, who's obviously against this. He sort of has a theory about what Harry Reid is trying to do. Listen to this.
He has a hard job here. He's trying to figure out how to get the votes. Republicans oppose a government-run insurance company, so we're not going to give him any votes for that. And some of his members don't like it either. So what he's got to try to do is to figure out a way to put the lipstick on the pig and make it attractive enough to vote for. I hate to use that metaphor, but some of us think that's not an inapt metaphor.
He hates to use that metaphor?
Really?
He needs a metaphor because 62% of Americans, that's quite a pig.
Including Republicans.
Well, that's, again, partly true, but don't forget, it's not just a majority that rules in the Senate. It's 60.
Right.
And here's the thing. There are a couple of Reid's Democrats who don't like this, and there's another school of thought around the Senate that's a bit of the converse to what Kyle was saying. A couple of other Republicans were saying yesterday, look, Harry Reid will not have the votes to pass this public option, but he has to show his best, hardest case for doing it. Show the liberal base, hey, we tried, we didn't have the votes, this is all I can do because I can't get 60 votes for it. Now, that's what Republicans are saying. If Harry Reid is the champion whip that some people think he is, this is going to be the real test of his leadership. Right now, he has about 57 or 58 votes for this. Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Evan Bayh of Indiana, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. Those are the three conservative to moderate Democrats who are not interested in this right now. So we'll see where they come down in the end.
We will definitely be keeping track. Todd Zwillick is the Takeaways Washington correspondent. And by the way, if you have questions about the public option, the politics behind it, any questions you may have about the health care bill, ask Todd Zwillick.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
He's taking your questions online and on the show. Go to thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Tee it up for Todd on the Takeaway website. Yes, we've got it. It's all Todd all the time. A Todd environment, a digital Todd environment. We hear from you all the time on the program, of course, and occasionally we hear a story that really makes us want to know more.
I just filed for bankruptcy. Never thought I would do that. Embarrassed, feel awful about it, use my credit card way too much. So I'm trying to live credit card free.
In the course of a conversation last week and yesterday about living without credit cards, Carrie called us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning.
You've had quite an experience going from a pretty successful retail rep to having a real serious problem with your cash flow. First of all, explain to me how you slipped, and we were using the word slippery slope yesterday, talking about what credit cards can do. Explain how you got on this slippery slope.
Well, you know what? My husband and I both have had really solid jobs and good careers over the years. And recently we had a major job change that took us to Charlotte. We had to sell our house in another state. Just as the housing was starting to drop down, we really lost our shirts on that house. And, you know, paid the difference in a credit card and thought we would, you know, pay that off with a lower interest rate. And just those things just started adding up. And then all of a sudden we were hit with a medical problem with our son where we had to pay up front, where insurance didn't cover it. And it just knocked us on our butts, and we had to really sit back and look at what we had done. And I was telling the producer yesterday, I don't think we paid attention. I honestly don't think we paid attention. And I think we're intelligent people. And all of a sudden, when we really put it all on one piece of paper, we went, oh, my God, how are we going to do this?
Now, why do you think we don't? And you're in a situation that millions of Americans are in, where a medical situation pushes you over the edge. And that edge is not really terribly clear to you until you put the stuff on paper. Why do you think, first of all, we don't put stuff on paper? And give me a little sense of the process when you put the stuff down, how you decided what had to go.
Well, you know what? Just like they were talking yesterday, everybody's got, you know, 5 credit cards, and, you know, the bills come in sporadically, and you can pick the day that they're due, and you don't really pay that much attention, and it gets paid directly out of your bank account. And we just didn't pay attention. Well, then I was actually sitting in the doctor's office waiting for my son, and I read an article about financial software that you can get for free called Mint.com. I went on there, plugged all of our stuff in, and went, okay, I knew we couldn't pay the bills, and now this program is telling me, how are you paying the bills? And we weren't.
Well, you filed for bankruptcy, and the one thing that struck us, and we only have a few seconds here, but I want, you know, when do you think the humiliation that you described on our website and to our producers is going to go away for you and your family? Because this is something, you're in the same boat with everyone in the United States.
You know, my husband was so nervous about me coming on the radio this morning. He's like, what if somebody we know hears you? And
hey, Carrie, that could be the best thing that could ever happen. Carrie from Charlotte, North Carolina, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Good morning. The government was suggesting that in order to reduce the risks of H1N1, people stay home if they're feeling sick, you know. But the question, John, is what happens if it's your home that's making you sick?
Your home is giving you the flu?
Well, no. It flu-like symptoms, absolutely. We're going to talk about toxic drywall in just a few moments. But first, some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has his work cut out, persuading moderate senators to support his new health care plans. He's in favor of the so-called public option, provided that states have the opportunity to opt out of it. The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick says Harry Reid has some difficult work ahead.
Harry Reid putting it in the bill doesn't mean it's going to get into final legislation. There are a lot of twists and turns and a lot of arms to be twisted before we actually find out if this public option is going to become law.
That's Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick.
In Iraq, a group linked to al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility for the bombings that left more than 150 people dead this week. The group calls itself the Islamic State of Iraq. It also claimed responsibility for an August attack in Baghdad that left around 100 dead. 4 months after exiting bankruptcy, automaker Chrysler is prepared to unveil a new lineup of cars. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. The lineup relies heavily on vehicles from Chrysler's Italian partner, Fiat. The paper says the company will abandon many of its traditional U.S. car models. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We've heard many stories about products coming out of China that are not safe. Poisonous pet food, contaminated toothpaste, and there were the Thomas the Train toys that included lead in the paint. There is another one coming out, and this is about what's in your home. 100,000 homes across 20 states in America used drywall from China that now turns out to possibly be toxic. We're joined now by Chris Hogg. He's the BBC's Shanghai correspondent. He's going to be able to tell us about what this means for trade. But let's go first to Luis Gonzalez. He's a Miami-Dade police officer and has a 3-year-old son who's been affected by Chinese drywall. He joins us from Miami. Good morning, Luis.
Hi, good morning.
You bought a home, and when you purchased the home, you smelled an odd smell, but you thought that was just a temporary thing, correct?
Yes. Actually, the house was closed down for about a year or so, so I thought it was just a stale smell to the house. Really didn't think anything of it.
Damp or something. And
yes.
When did you know that there was something seriously wrong?
About 6-7 months into the house, I started hearing the rumors of this Chinese drywall and how we should inspect, because a lot of the houses, when this house was built back in 2006, had this drywall. So as I started to look into the electrical outlets and the air conditioner, I noticed that all the copper wiring was black, and which is one of the signs of this drywall, these off gases. So that's when I started to really look into it, and I looked into the internet for help.
Okay, so you and your family have actually been ill, especially your 3-year-old son, with respiratory problems that you believe is caused by the drywall, and you've moved into an apartment, and you're still paying the mortgage on the original home.
Yes, I'm still paying the mortgage. I've called out for help. I called the VA. I called out the mortgage company, Wells Fargo, for help, and nobody wants to help out on this. Everybody just gives you the turns the face the other way.
So you're now in litigation with the builder to try and force them to replace the drywall.
Yes, I am.
Chris Hogg from Shanghai, good morning.
Good morning.
He talked about one of the signs that you've got toxic drywall in your home, which is metal turning black. So I understand what happens is the drywall from China is emitting sulfide gases. It turns your metal black. It can affect your wiring. And do we know for sure that this drywall is causing these things?
No, we don't. And this is the point, really, that that in America they are still trying to carry out these tests. They know there's a problem. The EPA has carried out tests on Chinese drywall. They found that it has sulfur and two organic compounds associated with acrylic paint. But they came to no conclusion on the health risks. So these technical investigations are still going on. And after talks between the U.S. safety watchdog and the China safety watchdog, the U.S. and China, they put out a statement saying that they're working together, continuing with these investigations to determine what caused this and to ensure that these problems don't recur.
So China has announced it will actually help out with this investigation. Correct?
Yes, China is already helping out with this investigation.
Is this a departure from how they've handled some of these other things? As I mentioned, the toothpaste thing issue, or pet food, or the Thomas the Train toys?
Certainly, I think it's fair to say that that kind of bad publicity has riled the Chinese, and certainly the kind of working together that we see is probably a lot closer than it was. But it was very interesting when you had this statement from these two safety watchdogs. I mean, certainly neither side was willing to take all the blame on themselves. On the American side, you had Inez Tenenbaum, the head of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, saying that it was important that drywall companies in China examine carefully their responsibilities to U.S. consumers suffering problems and do what is fair and just. And from the Chinese side, they were saying, look, this is people have to understand that this is a global supply chain problem, and everybody at every link in that supply chain has a responsibility. Basically, them saying it's not just our fault.
Chris Hogg, there's plenty of cooperation now, as you describe, but what's to prevent this dispute from becoming, and there's been a fair amount of cynicism in China that the U.S. uses environmental rules to manipulate trade disputes, and that it's actually not about contaminants at all?
I mean, certainly this, along with every other kind of dispute that or argument that's going on, always has the potential to blow up into something more serious. At this stage, though, with the U.S. President Barack Obama due to come early next month to China, I think both sides are going to be doing whatever they can to try to make sure that there are no grounds for anything to blow up in their face. And that's why you have this holding statement, if you like, saying we're working together on this.
Luis, let's go. Luis Gonzalez is a Miami-Dade police officer in Florida who's having trouble with the drywall in his home. We don't know for sure, Luis, that it's the drywall that's causing the. You're saying that you're having flu-like symptoms among your family, correct?
Right. Yes. Nobody knows for sure what it is. However, we've never had these symptoms in the past. And even before I knew about this drywall, I had been to an allergist several times because of these symptoms and the respiratory issues that I've been having. And I don't come up allergic with anything that they've checked for. So we're attributed to it now.
Have they disappeared since you left the home?
Not totally. I've only been out for about 2 weeks. And
okay.
Actually, I go back to the house every night myself. So it's my kid and my wife that are out completely.
So really the question here, Chris, is whether these negotiations with China are going to be fast enough to help someone like Luis, who can't afford both the mortgage and the rent on the new apartment he's in. Luis Gonzalez is a Miami-Dade police officer. He joined us from Miami. And Chris Hogg is a Shanghai correspondent with our partner, the BBC, talking about the possibly toxic drywall that came from China. It's currently in more than 100,000 homes across the United States. Coming up, we're going to be talking about manufacturing jobs that have been lost during this recession. What can those workers do now? How do they update their skills to get new jobs? We'll talk about that a little later. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. With the bloody attacks on Sunday in Baghdad that killed more than 150 people, including, as we learned yesterday, at least 28 children from a daycare center near the government facilities that were targeted, a U.S. military spokesman tried to put the best face on things.
I don't think there's a horrific breakdown in security. I do think that yesterday there was a particular instance where a high-profile attack did occur, but we see this as a small instance in terms of these occurring.
Small instance, as Brigadier General Steve Lanza, the chief U.S. military spokesman in Iraq, joining us now from our partner, the New York Times, is Rod Nordland in Baghdad. Good morning, Rod.
Good morning.
Let me just start by saying, on this program last week, you suggested that delays in the election in Iraq was going to possibly delay a withdrawal of U.S. troops. It seems as though, and we spoke yesterday with a lot of people in Iraq, that these attacks are targeted at those very elections. What is the political situation like this morning? Rickety or moving forward?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that they're targeting the political process and trying to interfere with getting the elections on time. It seems, in this case, to have boomeranged on them, though. The bombings on Sunday actually appear to have galvanized the political leadership in Iraq to come to an agreement on election law. We'll see. They still have to actually pass it through parliament. But in pretty much record time, less than 2 days of meetings, a group called the Political Council for National Security actually managed to come to an agreement. And that group, it's made up of the president, the vice presidents, prime minister, and party leaders. So it pretty much represents all the same groupings and political views that there are in the parliament. It's just a smaller body. So it's fairly hopeful, in short.
And it's interesting to see that a military suicide attack by, and it was claimed today, a radical al-Qaeda group, was responsible for the attack, that this attack is answered by political changes as opposed to more military activities. Is that what we're going to see? Attack followed by speeded up political activities? And how long do you think the Iraqi government can sustain that?
Well, I think that they know they have to pull the elections off. It would be a tremendous defeat for them. And I think they're, in a way, looking at that in military terms, that in order to win in this latest round with insurgents and terrorists, they've got to pull the election off and pull it off on schedule.
Literally fighting suicide bombers with elections. You know, that was part of the rhetoric of the original invasion back in 2003. But we're seeing what's happening, now quite literally a realization of that to some extent. Do these politicians in Iraq, in the minute before we go, have the momentum of the people of Iraq behind them in any sense?
I think people are really fed up with these big attacks. But the important thing to remember, the last two spectacular attacks, the one on August 19th and the pair on August 19th, and these two, were aimed at government institutions, ministries, rather than just at whatever large gathering of civilians they could find, like in a marketplace or in front of a mosque or something. And so I think that's really galvanized the government in a way maybe it hadn't before to they see it as a political attack and they're responding in a political way because there really isn't a military way to defeat this kind of attack.
Well, and if the government delivers, there may be permanent political consequences of benefit to the Iraqi people. Rod Nordland, New York Times correspondent in Baghdad, talking about political responses to those bloody suicide bombings over the weekend. Thank you, Rod.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up in a few minutes, if your industry disappeared tomorrow, would you have the skills to move into a new industry? We're asking you today about retraining. How does retraining work? How long does it take? And does it actually end up finding you a job? We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Today, the president talks about clean energy when he tours a solar power plant in Florida.
Also in Florida, we're expecting NASA's latest rocket to blast off within the hour. Launch team officials have told NASA that the T4 build-in hold is actually been extended. So 9:24 a.m. is now the launch time, but we will check and see and follow that all this morning. Looking ahead in Washington, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid now has to get moderate Democrats to back a public health option. It's in the bill he'll take to the Senate floor, and those are just some of the stories we're following this morning.
In the helicopters that went down in Afghanistan, 14 Americans were killed. Three of them were Drug Enforcement Administration agents, and that's a reminder to all of us back in the United States that there's more than one battle going on in Afghanistan. On one sense, we're battling the Taliban and Al-Qaeda agents. On the other, we're battling the economy there to try and teach farmers to stop growing opium and to begin growing other crops. To check in quickly on the state of the opium industry in Afghanistan, Gretchen Peters is with us. She's the author of Seeds of Terror. That's a book that traces the links between Afghanistan's drug trade and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda insurgents. Good morning, Gretchen.
Good morning.
Can you give us an update? Are there any good signs in this effort to revamp the economy and get farmers to plant something other than poppy?
Well, I think the new strategy, as I had been arguing in my book, was to take the focus off the farmers and to put it on the drug traffickers. There are thousands and thousands of people growing poppy, and they're actually at the low end of the totem pole in the drugs trade. They're actually the victims of it. They're in many cases forced to grow it, or they have no alternatives. The drug traffickers are really the bad guys. And yesterday's mission, in which DEA agents and U.S. troops were killed, was one such mission, to go after the center where drugs were stockpiled and processed into or refined into opium base and heroin.
So are there signs of success in this particular effort?
Well, I think it's too early to say that there's success. There have been some major seizures and some major takedowns this year. In one operation alone, U.S. drug DEA agents working with Afghan troops and American troops seized 90 tons of drugs and took down a major command and control center by the Taliban. So, yes, there have been some successes. I think it's too early. This really is just getting off the ground. The DEA, for example, is undergoing what it calls its largest plus-up in the agency's history. Increasing the number of agents they have there to, I think, about 80. And yesterday's events were very unfortunate, but I think, unfortunately, there will be more like them. The compounds where drugs are stored and where drugs are refined are very heavily guarded. They're very elaborate. These are not operations that are run by fanatics who live in caves. They're extremely well funded and well guarded.
Kind of reminds us of the gun battles in Colombia with some of the drug lords there. Gretchen Peters, thank you. She's the author of Seeds of Terror, a book that traces the links between Afghanistan's drug trade and insurgents in Afghanistan. She joined us from D.C.
It's time to recapture the spirit of innovation that has always fueled American economic success. It's time we had an economy that was driven not just by foreign debt, but by the power of America's imagination.
That's President Barack Obama speaking during the presidential campaign in April of 2008, talking about the power of America's imagination. Joining us now is Robin Ambrosi, laid off in January of 2006 from Sony, retraining to become an occupational therapist. Robin, good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Now, we are continuing our discussion of what Barack Obama and Vice President Biden are going to be doing today. They're going to be at photo ops in different places in the country talking about retraining Americans for green jobs. Is that spirit of America's imagination moving in you, Robin, this morning?
Well, most definitely. I come from a steel mill town and a coal mining town, and those jobs are just gone. It seems that the up-and-coming fields are the medical field and that's what I chose to pursue.
And, you know, the photo ops are going to take a few minutes in these cities of Wilmington, Delaware, and Arcadia, Florida, looking at photovoltaic energy and electric cars. But when you decide to retrain yourself, you're really entering into a very long journey. Robin, explain yours a little bit, as you could, briefly.
My journey is going to take 18 to 22 months. I'm attending a career institute. It's called Kaplan Career Institute in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I'm doing this through the Trade Act that was made available by the government that allows people who lose their jobs due to industries moving overseas. Like, I worked for Sony, and they moved to Mexico.
All right. Robin Ambrosi, using some of that stimulus money, or money that is intended to stimulate the economy one way or another. Hal Higdon, president of Ozarks Technical Community College in Springfield, Missouri. How many people would you say at your school are embarked on a similar journey as Robin there?
Well, out of our 13,000 students, there's probably at least half of them involved in some sort of technical or allied health program designed to get them to work within 24 months.
All right. Well, we're talking about work here on Tuesday on The Takeaway. And Beth Kumbleiter, of course, always joins us for these discussions. Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Now, we've got Robin talking about her 18-month journey from the technical field to the medical field.
Occupational therapy,
We got Hal Higdon with, by my count, something on the order of 6,000 people.
Community colleges, exactly.
That's some serious economic power. What do we know nationally about retraining and how difficult it is?
Well, it's pretty difficult, but a lot of money is being poured into it. This year, we're seeing about $3 billion poured into it. Half of that is this Worker Investment Act that's been around since 1998, and that's about $1 billion. And on top of that, President Obama put in about $1.5 billion in stimulus money. So we're seeing $3 billion. There's other federal dollars as well. And those dollars trickle down to the states, community colleges. Community colleges have a huge boom right now in enrollment because of this, people retraining.
Well, Hal Higdon, listening to what Beth Kobliner says right there, the president and the vice president are going to be talking about green jobs and retraining for green jobs. Is Ozark Technical Community College one of the places where that's going to be happening?
Yes, it is. We're already moving toward lots of green jobs, particularly in the HVAC, and also the people that will now do the energy audits.
Right. HVAC is heating and air conditioning, okay.
It is. And everyone's looking at the building envelope differently, our construction trades program, your HVAC and heating and air, and then the entire gamut, not to mention jobs that will support future development in the green area.
You know, Hal, this is a great discussion, and we got limited time, but I got to ask you, how do you deal with the disappointments that some people have when they make missteps and end up in an industry that's going away, and they call up the technical college and say, what do you got for me now?
Well, it's happening a great deal. Every community in America are seeing plant closings, and what we have seen in our community is many of the plants that had the lowest skilled jobs. So we saw a lot of people lose their jobs who may not have even had a GED and may have been working 20 years in one industry.
And that's a tough turnaround. Beth, I want you to jump in here.
But, John, you bring up a really good point, because there was a study done last year by the Department of Labor that looked at retraining and how successful it is. And what they did was a very intensive study comparing those who got retraining versus those who didn't get retraining. And these are people who lost their jobs.
Got it.
And they found after 2 years, actually, that people who did not get the retraining were actually making a little bit more money because they were in jobs.
Ooh.
So, and after 3 to 5 years, there were modest gains from retraining, particularly for women for some reason, but not huge gains.
So, Robin Ambrosi, it may take you a long time to get a return on your investment there as an occupational therapist, right?
I don't believe that's true, because in our area there's almost a 9% unemployment rate, and Pennsylvania is an aging community. So the medical field always seems to be growing, so that's why I chose the avenue that I did.
All right, well, you've done your homework, Robin Ambrosi. When are you out? When do you graduate?
April of 2011.
It's marked on her calendar there. Robin Ambrosi laid off in 2006 from Sony, retraining to become an occupational therapist. Good luck also to Hal Higdon, president of Ozarks Technical Community College in Springfield, Missouri. And always thanks to Takeaway contributor Beth Kobliner. So we're checking in with you. Tell us, have you been retraining for the changing economy? What would you like to be trained for? Are you thankful that you got retrained?
Hi, my name is Matt. I've been a tractor trailer driver for 5 years, and
been out of work for 2 years. Now I work in an office, making about half of what I did before. But hey, I got a job, and it pays more than unemployment does. Those same tractor-trailer jobs that paid $18 an hour now pay $11 to $12 an hour for local driving.
That is the whole story right there.
Right there.
The whole story.
I know, in 20
That's
seconds.
All you need. Go ahead and podcast us or tell us an even better story about retraining in this changing economy at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
In Afghanistan, Senator John Kerry talks about the Russians.
We're not the Soviets. We're not there to colonize, to conquer, to remake Afghanistan in our image, or to impose an ideology on its people.
And on Kremlin-owned TV, a Russian military analyst talks about a regime change in Afghanistan that became...
Then it went seriously astray, and the political military coup d'etat, with the Soviet deployment of troops in Afghanistan, later expanding in a full-fledged counterinsurgency operation.
A regime change becomes a major military operation. Sound familiar? We are not the Soviets. Heard that before? The day after one of the bloodiest days in Afghanistan, who do you believe about the mission there? Reality TV. Try and find some in Afghanistan. We keep looking on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, October 27th. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Coming up, we'll look at the push to revive the public option, or was it never dead? Also, the latest on the Northwest flight that just kept going past its destination city last week, and the staggering rise of child abuse in the United States.
But first, Saad Mohseni joins us. He's the director of the Mobi Group, largest media organization in Afghanistan. Mr. Mohseni, thanks for joining us this morning. And do people in Afghanistan believe that events in your country are unfolding just like that Soviet invasion, a regime? Regime change, followed by a long, bloody counterinsurgency, ending in a withdrawal?
Well, I don't think so. I think that the Soviet experience is quite different. A million Afghans were killed, a million Afghans were injured, and we still carry the scars of that occupation. If anything, the Afghans are disappointed that the internationals are not doing more on the ground.
Well, we'll look at the headlines on the ground in Kabul. Continuing our discussion with Saad Mohseni, stay with us. We'll talk with you more in just a few minutes. But first,
in the headlines in the next half hour, we're expecting NASA's latest rocket to blast off for a test flight. The Ares rocket is the first step in NASA's effort to take astronauts back to the moon. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's health care bill is headed to the Senate floor with the public option. Under the plan, states would be able to opt out of it. The president praised that bill at a fundraising event last night.
All the naysayers, you remember, I mean, back in August, oh, this thing is dead, it's terrible, the people are out. And what do? We just keep on working.
Harry Reid will now have to persuade moderate Democrats to support the public option in his bill.
The president is talking green jobs today. He'll tour a solar energy plant in Florida. And the Washington Post reports this morning that a former Marine has become the first U.S. official to resign in protest over the war in Afghanistan. The Post says Matthew Ho worked for the State Department in Afghanistan. He quit after saying the war is fueling the insurgency. A court in France has convicted the Church of Scientology of organized fraud, but the court in France did not ban the group from operating in that country. Markets closed down again yesterday, but the Dow opens this hour at 98.68. The S&P starts at 10.67, and the Nasdaq begins at 21.42. What would you like to be retrained for in this economy?
This is Sean from New Baltimore, Michigan. We're training our employees to look out for automation and the new technological unemployment world where there are going to be not enough jobs and way too many people. So what are we going to do now?
Pie in the sky or your retraining story in a changing economy? How do you change careers? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Keep the stories coming. Good morning, everyone. Well, the headlines are dominated by this story yesterday that we reported on in Afghanistan. Three helicopters down in Afghanistan and 14 Americans killed, seven of them troops, three Drug Enforcement Agency agents, and certainly a bloody day. And the Taliban claiming responsibility for bringing down both of them. The truth, of course, lies somewhere in the murky details, although the headlines this morning in the New York Times, very, very clear, 14 Americans die in Afghan helicopter crashes. There's also another headline in the New York Times, Celeste. I don't know if you noticed this. German limits on war facing Afghan reality, an indication of some of the troubles right. within NATO as this conflict continues. Continuing now our discussion with Saad Mohseni, who's director of the Mobi Group, the largest media organization in Afghanistan. He joins us from studio in Kabul, Afghanistan. Saad, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And from Fargo, North Dakota, Lieutenant Colonel Sean Stroud is a former director of strategic communications at the U.S. Army Combined Arms Center. And let me just go to you first, Lieutenant Colonel Sean Stroud. How frustrating is it for military commanders in Afghanistan to deal with an event of this type, which, whether it's the Taliban shooting the helicopters down or whether it's equipment failure, the tragedy seems to me in different directions to be equally significant and equally painful.
John, certainly. I mean, first and foremost, it is a tragedy, and the loss of those brave Americans' lives is just is something that we deeply, sincerely want to express our condolences to those families. But certainly, the whole way that the Taliban claims responsibility for that is disturbing. But as you know, the military, U.S. military especially, first and foremost, is that they must be truthful. And, of course, they've got to conduct an investigation. I'm sure at this point they're working as fast and as diligently as possible. And once they get all those details, they'll know better. But at this point, I read those same headlines as you did, and I saw the statement that said they're 98% certain that it was not, in fact, enemy fire that brought the helicopter down.
And, of course, for the U.S. audience, the headlines focus on the tragedy of the death of the U.S. soldiers and the investigation that is ongoing. Saad Mohseni, director of the Mobi Group, what are the headlines in Kabul this morning on your various broadcast and media outlets?
Well, the helicopter story was our third story. The top story was Dr. Abdullah's conditions for participating in the second round of
and
our
we
elections.
Should, we should. Dr. Abdullah, of course, is the former foreign minister of the Afghan government, who is the opposition candidate challenging Hamid Karzai, and has set conditions for participating in the runoff.
Correct. So, I mean, that story has been dominating our headlines for some weeks now. But certainly, the tragedy with a military aircraft is, of course, also newsworthy, given that the Taliban tend to take credit for any sort of accident that happens with the U.S. military.
Saad, I'm wondering, many people say that the people of Pakistan hate the Taliban. Maybe people say that the Afghan people don't necessarily support them, but they're afraid of what they'll do to them in their local communities. And I'm wondering, who's more credible, though? I mean, if you remove fear out of it, which I agree is a large proposition, but if you take people's fear of the Taliban out, when they hear the Taliban claim responsibility for this helicopter attack, for example, and NATO forces say they had nothing to do with it, which source to the Afghan people is more credible? Who do they believe?
Well, it just depends. I mean, I think that of late, the U.S. military has been a lot more credible. I think over the last 2 or 3 months, they've adopted a new policy, which is to, be as truthful as possible. A few months back, you know, they were telling a lot more fibs. But I think we've noticed over the last few months, in particular with the Kunduz incident a few weeks back, when a whole bunch of civilians were killed inadvertently. People, especially the media outlets, are beginning to think that this new team in Kabul, the military public affairs team is a lot more honest. So
it just depends on the incident. Let's go directly then. Saad Mohseni, you make a phone call personally to General McChrystal. Does he call you back?
Well, I my news team makes a call to Admiral Smith's team in Kabul, and they respond immediately, yes.
And that's the NATO commanders there in Kabul, and I would suspect that they're very interested in getting their message onto your various media outlets, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But Lieutenant Colonel Sean Stroud, the Taliban may not have shot these helicopters down, but is it possible that vigilance and increased vigilance because of increased use of anti-aircraft weapons on the part of the Taliban has made the pilots have to ascend very, very quickly and dangerously or land very, very quickly and dangerously, and that could have contributed to an accident like this?
Well, John, it's tough to speculate on that, but certainly, I mean, our aviators are folks that are flying those aircraft. I mean, they will certainly adapt any different techniques and procedures that they would need to, depending on the situation. So anything is possible. Obviously, the enemy, in this case the Taliban, they can adapt just as aggressively to the way we are maneuvering our helicopters. But certainly, I think once the investigation comes out, we'll be able to learn more and to get those full details. But to your point earlier, I think it's interesting you mentioned that about calling General McChrystal. I mean, what it is to a public affairs team, if they have established those relationships and they are responsive to the needs of the media, I mean, that's what's paramount here is that you, just like you said, John, if Saad can pick up the phone and call Admiral Greg Smith, who's in Kabul, and he gets back to him, I mean, that's what's really key here. It's that timeliness of the information and getting back to those media.
Right. Okay, but it sounds really, really hunky-dory here. But Saad Mohsenian, how does somebody in Kandahar, okay, hear the story that you broadcast or publish in Kabul?
Well, I mean, obviously, we have a national network of television stations with a national reach. So, and media has been one of the few successes in Afghanistan. So we have hundreds of radio stations, over 20 television stations.
Any idea of your ratings?
Various publications. Well, at Tolo TV, one of our television stations has a 56% market share for television viewers. But what's also interesting is that almost half the population gets to watch television at some stage, and over 96% of the population listens to the radio. So we do have people are very engaged. And this goes back to the Soviet days when people had to find out what was going on.
Well,
they're very media savvy.
Let's set that in context. I'm wondering how cynical the people of Afghanistan are. Certainly during the Soviet period, the insurgent groups, the Mujahideen, funded by the United States, took great credit for shooting down these huge Soviet airplanes with tiny little missiles, handheld Stingers. There were some supplied by the United States. What's the potential that an incident like these helicopter crashes would become the same sort of propaganda opportunity for the Taliban? Or are people just fed up and that tactic doesn't work anymore?
Well, it doesn't really work anymore, and there's no consistency. I mean, if they were shooting down helicopters on a daily basis, like what happened with Soviet aircraft, then of course people will take notice. But, I mean, one thing you have to bear in mind is that the Mujahideen had an 80% approval rating, maybe higher, whereas the Taliban, according to a BBC poll recently, NBC BBC poll, their approval rating is less than 10%. So you're dealing with a totally different movement here in Afghanistan.
So, Lieutenant Colonel Sean Stroud, the hearts and minds battle is already won?
No, John. I would say we continue to work very diligently to help to build up the Afghani security force apparatus. I was very encouraged to see President Obama's decision to appoint a 3-star U.S. Army general, Lieutenant General William Caldwell, to take over the NATO training mission, a joint command. I think that will go a long way as we continue to work to build up the Afghani security forces. And again, it goes back to presence on the ground. We've seen our Marines, the soldiers, getting those soldiers out there with the villagers, letting the villagers understand that they're going to be there and they're committed and that we're going to be there with those Afghanis.
From Fargo, North Dakota, Lieutenant Colonel Sean Stroud joined us, a former director of strategic communication at the U.S. Army Combined Arms Center. Saad Mohsenian, one last question for you. The Washington Post is reporting this morning that a former Marine, part of the NATO force in Afghanistan, has resigned, saying that the NATO counterinsurgency campaign is actually fueling the insurgency. What are Afghans likely to make of that report?
Well, I think in some parts of the country, certainly people will be more sensitive to the presence of international troops. But most Afghans are crying. I mean, they're crying out for assistance on the ground. There's not much faith in the local security apparatus. And most people are hoping that the international forces become more engaged in what's happening on the ground. So that, I don't think that's necessarily true right across the country. It may be true in some parts of the country.
Well, deciphering the message all over Afghanistan for both U.S. and Afghan audiences, Saad Mohsenian, thanks so much for helping us with all that. He's the director of the Mobi Group, the largest media organization in Afghanistan, including radio and television stations, some of them more than 50% share. Saad, thanks so much for being with us. And, you know, it's the challenge of trying to figure out what source to believe. Where does the credibility come from in Afghanistan?
Right, when you're out in the country and have no other way of finding perspective.
Or your president is Hamid Karzai.
Well, exactly. There you go. That's a great example. How do you know what's true and what isn't?
And the biggest businessman in your neighborhood is an opium dealer. or something like that, or a militia person.
I was going to say, or someone threatening your life if you go to the polls, for example. Yeah, that's difficult.
Coming up, the opening of the NBA season, the public option, and is the grass greener on your side of the hemisphere? We'll find out.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on stories we want you to stay on top of this week. And first up, Louise Story joins us, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, and right here in the studio. Great to see you again.
Good to see you.
So it's certainly not new that if you invest money, you want to make money.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not really that new either that you would invest in organizations that have a particular sort of social responsible kind of approach to life on this planet. But the firm Nascens, a Swiss investment company called Nascens, yesterday announced that they were going to launch a new fund in January, an investment fund that's going to invest in companies that have more women on their boards of directors. First of all, what's the track record for this so-called socially responsible investing, and how's it likely to work here?
So here they're looking at the boards of directors, and they're seeing that there are not many women on many of them, but they have a bunch of research which they've cited that shows that there's a correlation between having a woman on your board of directors and having your company's stock do better. So they're not saying it's a cause, so we don't know if the women are causing that, but they're saying that they see a better track record.
And they're just saying the stock does better, not that the earnings of the company are better or that the performance of the company or sales of the company.
They also say return on equity, which is a financial measure that's tied to profit. And you know, often the stock moves because of profits, not always, but...
Now, a lot of people hearing this story will say Carly Fiorina of Hewlett Packard. That didn't work out. And then others will say, but hey, what about Xerox? Ursula over at Xerox is the head of Xerox and doing a fabulous
job. And
John,
I mean, the problem is it's so hard to generalize based on these couple famous women, right? I mean, most women who are on boards of directors, you don't even hear about. In fact, you don't even hear about most boards of directors. Do you know who's on the board at Walt Disney World? You don't know. And so these are people, you don't know who they are precisely, but they do have a lot of influence over the companies. A lot of these banks we've been talking about in the financial crisis have done a lot of reform of their boards. In fact, one of my favorite remarks that's come out of the financial crisis was the Minister of Equality in Britain said, maybe if it was Lehman Sisters, we wouldn't have had the problem.
Really?
So there are people asserting that we need more women.
Easy to say.
Right.
So is this a boutique investment play, or is it actually solid economics that hopes to change the culture of corporate boards?
They're saying it's solid economics. They're citing studies by McKinsey and Catalyst, and they're saying that this really will give a better return. They've already raised $200 million. They hope to raise $2 billion. So they're saying it'll be a better return. They've got two former prime ministers on the board of the fund, the prime minister from Canada and the prime minister from New Zealand, and they have Tony Blair's wife on their board. So they've got some big backers here, and the idea is let's get more women in these boardrooms. Maybe they'll shake something up.
And if they get enough money in their fund, maybe some women will get the call.
That's true. They can push change. That's true.
Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times.
Thank
Thanks you. So much.
And now we'll go to sports with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, in football last night, the Philadelphia Eagles beat Washington 27-17, the nation's capital. Do we see any?
Let's move to Philly. Everything in Philly is wonderful.
Well, they were actually in D.C. when they played, so you can move to D.C.
The hapless Redskins. Their coaching controversies, their ownership controversies led to six sacks of their quarterback Jason Campbell. They turned the ball over four times. They're proving that they're one of the most inept franchises in the NFL.
Wait, I'm from Detroit.
Yeah, you got some convincing to do.
No, I would actually say that Detroit is improving every week, whereas the Redskins are not improving every week. So I would say that they're one of the most inept franchises.
You hear that, Detroit? Detroit is not the worst. So this is pretty much more about how bad the Redskins were and not whether or not the Eagles were.
I think the Eagles had to bounce back from their big loss at Oakland the week before. So I think the Eagles made a statement. So I think that they were in good shape. But I think it definitely is how bad the Redskins were.
Okay. So the NBA is going to kick off tonight. Clearly, there's a lot of very, very excited basketball fans, probably including you. What are we going to watch here?
So let me just give you a quick, brief rundown. In the Eastern Conference, you have the Celtics, and I think with the addition of Rasheed Wallace, they're the same team that they were when they won that championship. I'm really looking for them to come back roaring this year. The second, you have the Cavs with of course, LeBron James,
and
they had added Shaquille O'Neal. But look for Shaquille O'Neal. If he's not effective by February, look for them to try and unload him if he's not making something happen. Behind them, you have the Magic, Orlando Magic, who came in as the in the finals last year. They took away Hedo Turkoglu. They added Vince Carter. They're going to be the same type of team that they were last year, except they added some other players, so they're going to give some defensive help for the other team. So those are my top three in the Eastern Conference. In the Western Conference, of course, you have the Los Angeles Lakers. And they're starting five, the Fisher, Bryant, Artest, Paul Gasol, Andrew Bynum. They're dangerous, and they have Hall of Fame coach Phil Jackson. Coming up also is my favorite team with my favorite player, and not my favorite team personally, but my favorite player, Manu Ginobili, on the San Antonio Spurs. I love the Spurs, and I think they're going to do excellent this year. They're going to challenge the Lakers in seven in the Western Conference Finals. And then also you have the Denver Nuggets. If the Denver Nuggets don't make it to the championships this year and win, then their coach, George Karl, is going to get fired. You won't see him for 2011. And my pick is that this year the championship is going to be the Lakers versus the Celtics, which looks a lot like 1980. But it's 2010 coming up. So I think that you're not going to see a big power shift in the NBA. You're going to see more of the same. And some of the other teams like the Bulls, Detroit. Look for Detroit, actually. And I'm saying this not just because I love Detroit, and so do you.
Yes.
But also look for Detroit, actually, to be a sleeper team in the East that could challenge the big powers going down the stretch.
It's tough against the West, though. It's all West.
It is all West. Yeah. Right there.
The Lakers are the team everyone loves to hate. That's the Ibrahim
Abdul. The Lakers are the Yankees of the NBA.
They are. It's true. Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
So our last takeout is about credit cards. That discussion continues. We're continuing to get a great response after talking about why people and how people are living without them with Beth Kobliner yesterday.
There is a revolt going on. People are mad as hell, and they're not going to take it anymore when it comes to credit cards.
And millions of people are living without credit cards, so we heard a lot of stories from people who don't. Kelly in South Carolina is one.
I'm currently living without any credit cards and without a bank account. I've removed myself from the banking system just because of the outrageous overdraft fees and whatnot. I may reconsider entering again once the new law passes, hopefully, that would limit their ability to overdraft charge and the crazy fees and whatnot.
But some of us told you why you want to hang on to the plastic in your wallet, like James from Augusta, Georgia.
I have a credit card because I need it to make sure I take care of my bills every month, because I cannot afford to overdraft my checking account. And at the end of the month, I make sure to pay off the credit card, but I certainly don't go shopping with the credit card.
Sandra in New York agrees. She emails us, "Why should I ever want to get rid of my credit cards? I pay my bill in full every month, so I have the advantage of the float. Plus, I get points that I can use for airline flights or whatever. If you don't carry a balance on your card, there's no downside."
But how do you deal with emergencies? We were asking you that question.
I generally have money in the bank for that kind of thing. Otherwise, I guess I would go to an older relative and ask.
Kind of the same story. Maybe talk to an older relative.
Older relative, National Bank. I got a call from Deborah from Mount Vernon.
My concern is that older relatives are not the bank. I'm not sure that older relatives ever are repaid for except in love. But that doesn't put gas in the car.
You folks are talking to each other out there. Continue to do it at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Todd Zwillick, our D.C. correspondent, brings us the public option. It's still alive. It never died.
Good morning. The public option is in on the health care bill, and we know we're going to have to read that fine print carefully, right? Todd Zwillick's going to be here in just a moment to point out the devil in the detail and answer your questions. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 32 minutes past the hour. NASA now says it'll launch its newest rockets in about 15 minutes. The weather's been causing delays all morning long. It's only expected to be up in the air for about 2 minutes. The short journey is part of NASA's effort to return astronauts to the moon. In Iraq, a group linked to Al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility for the bombings that left more than 150 people dead this week. The group calls itself the Islamic State of Iraq. It also claimed responsibility for an August attack in Baghdad that left around 100 dead.
New private study shows that Amtrak is apparently understating the amount of money it needs from the government. That's according to an initiative of the Pew Charitable Trust. Taxpayers spent about $32 for each Amtrak passenger last year, four times Amtrak's official estimate. Former slugger Mark McGwire will join the staff of the St. Louis Cardinals in the spring as the team's hitting coach. Cardinals manager Tony La Russa says he's glad to have him.
I think he's going to be a natural in that regard because he's so sincere and he's got a lot to offer.
La Russa will also be returning to the Cardinals for a 15th season. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
As we've been saying all morning long, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is now backing the public option. We've got Todd Zwillick, Takeaways Washington correspondent, with us to talk about this. And Todd, I think you remember probably this from Max Baucus.
My job is to put together a bill that gets 60 votes. Now I can count. And no one has been able to show me how we can count up to 60 votes with a public option in the bill.
Remember that, Todd? Remember?
I sure do.
Remember? Yep. Everybody saying there's no way we could get this bill passed with a public option in it. Can Harry Reid count? Do they count differently?
They might count differently. This is all going to come down to what kind of a whip Harry Reid is. Max Baucus might still be right about that. There is no indication right now that Harry Reid does have 60 votes for this public option with the opt-out that he says is going to be in the bill. So what's the calculation? He either thinks that he can use other parts of this bill, and there are so many moving parts of this bill, to get those wavering moderate to conservative Democrats on board with this. Or another school of thought is Harry Reid knows he's not going to get the votes for this public option, but he has a Democratic political base that's writing letters, that's on the blogs, that's on television, that really, really wants this, and he has to show his best effort. Look, we tried. You wanted the public option, Democrats? Here it was. I only got 58 votes. What else do you want from me? It's one of those two things. We'll see.
So, Todd, we've been telling our listeners all morning that if they have questions about the public option or the health care bill, they can ask you. And we've gotten some responses. Bob emails us, will the public option now being considered be able to lower health care costs by bargaining with providers? What's the answer?
Well, that's the idea. According to the Congressional Budget Office, which has taken a look at some of the public option bills coming out of the House, the answer is yes. It shouldn't be able to lower costs as much as a public option that was based on Medicare. Doesn't look like Congress is going to get something like that. But the way it would lower costs is that the federal government is a pretty big negotiator. You know, that's how the markets work. The more market clout you have, the lower you can get your prices. So the idea here is you sit down at the table with hospitals, doctor groups, clinics, drug companies, and you can get a lower price. So the CBO says, yes, it can lower prices.
So here's a question from Steve dealing with that Medicare question.
What strikes me is that it appears that hospitals, doctors, and medical caregivers cannot survive on what Medicare pays anyway, seniors or not. How can we possibly expect Medicare rates to work for the rest of us?
And you're saying they're not expecting the Medicare rates to work for the rest of us, but are they going to pay enough that will help the doctors perform procedures?
Well, one of the ideas the Democrats had here was to base a public option on what's called on Capitol Hill Medicare plus 5, and that means Medicare rates plus 5%, so an extra 5% premium. Although it's starting to look like that approach may not happen here. Harry Reid has not chosen that route. He has chosen a public option based on negotiated rates, not based on Medicare, based on the same kind of negotiations that insurance companies and doctors and hospitals do now. It's just the government negotiating. The House has not settled this yet. There were reports last week that Nancy Pelosi didn't have the votes for a public option based on Medicare. She says those reports are premature and she's still trying for it. So we'll be seeing probably this week where she comes down on that.
And then we have one more email here from someone calling themselves North C. Sue. This person writes, does the current health care opt-out option specify how states would choose to opt out? Is the default for states to accept the plan and then require states to vote to opt out? Also, does the option specify how the state would choose to opt out? Unfortunately, I live in a conservative state that might choose the opt-out option.
Yeah, well, this is a little bit sketchy. Believe me, North CSU has a great question because it's the same question all of us were asking the leadership staff yesterday, and they weren't providing any answers. I'm not sure that it's been quite decided. We have one or two details. Opt-out does mean yes, we're told. All states would start off with a public option for a year or two or three, and then to get out of it would have to opt out probably with the normal legislative process in their state. So,
but would they opt out by having to demonstrate that they've increased coverage in their state or deliver some sort of service, or would they just opt out by saying, never mind?
Right.
Unclear. That's a great question. Do you have to show that you're providing the coverage some other way for your residents in your state, or can you just say, we don't have to justify it, we want out, and just pass a law that says out? That's a great question, unclear at this point.
We've been hearing a lot about the Republicans' response, and here's Republican Senator John Kyle.
They're trying to wrap it in different colored ribbons.
Some like to call it a co-op. Some like to say, well, it only triggers if certain things happen, things which are bound to happen. Or, states could opt out if they could get the Secretary of HHS to allow them to opt out, and so on. All of that is political activity to try to make it easier for people to vote for something that their constituents don't really want them to vote for.
You know, Todd, we've been hearing these kind of responses, poo-pooing the measures in this health care bill. And I'm wondering, they're saying they won't vote for a public option, but was there any sign that they'd vote for the bill without the public option in it?
There really never was. The Republican leadership was never on board with this. Of course, this was always about Olympia Snowe and one or two other moderate senators. By the way, Olympia Snowe, quote, very disappointed that Harry Reid has included this public option. So she's not supporting this, but there are a lot of twists and turns and dozens of amendments before we get to a final answer on that.
Okay, thanks so much. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. And as you can keep going with your questions and send them to thetakeaway.org.
Yeah, and Todd, we'll take your questions. We're also talking about jobs and how they've been rapidly changing in this economy. Retraining sounds good. It's a great photo op, but if you've actually done it, what's the story?
I've had two quote-unquote midlife crises in my life. Worked in private business for about 15 years before I got tired of it, and at age 38 went back to school, got a journalism degree, but couldn't make any money at it, so went back to business, then realized again why I'd left in the first place. So about 9 years ago, I was applied and was accepted into the New York City Teaching Fellows Program, where I've been a high school teacher in the Bronx for many, many years in the public school system. After several and many jobs, I finally have a career. I'm very happy about it.
So great. I could have told him about the journalism one, though. Tell us your story at 877-8MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're waiting for the launch of the Ares 1X rocket that's on the launch pad. It may launch in the next 2 minutes. We'll be right back. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. We're going to be talking about grass now.
Green jobs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Literally green. Mark Simmons is a research scientist at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center of the University of Texas at Austin. And the reason we are talking to Mark Simmons today is he thinks he's found the solution to our lawn problem. Maybe, John, maybe you didn't realize we had a lawn problem.
I do not have a lawn problem.
But, Mark, we do have a lawn problem. We've discovered recently through satellite imaging that there's about 40 million acres of lawn in the United States, correct?
That's right. It's a significant area. In fact, it's now already considered the largest irrigated crop in the U.S.
The largest irrigated crop in the U.S. And the reason this is a problem is because of what?
Well, I think that the main issues have been that it's a huge resource sink up till now. You know, we've essentially, over the last 50 years, developed lawns in this country to be a single species, which has really been on life support in terms of things like water inputs and fertilizer and pesticides. And in this day and age of sustainability, this ecological footprint is really too high, and so it needs some modification.
I read a comment from an environmental lawyer calling lawns absolutely insane, and I assume that you've agreed with them because you've been researching a new kind of grass there in Texas. What kind of grass have you discovered?
Well, the nice thing is it's actually not a new type of grass at all. It's something that's been around for a few thousand years. What we've been looking at is, rather than looking at, up to now, we've been using non-native species, and they've been highly bred for the purpose of creating that nice green velvet carpet. But what we did, we took a slightly different approach. We're very keen on serving particular environmental problems using native species. And so what we did is we simulated what nature does and other grasslands all around the world do, and that's you don't have one species, you have a whole collection, a suite of species, if you will. So what we did, we selected locally native species, which all looked kind of the same, and, you know, the botanist could tell them apart, but essentially they looked the same. And we simulated a real sort of short grass prairie. But to the extent that now they're all growing together, it's a nice dense turf, but it has all the added advantages of being native species.
But, you know, can I grow this grass you've developed in Texas? Can I grow that in New Jersey?
Right. Well, a lot of the species they grow all the way up to Canada. Some of them are, a couple of them are more local. But the point is, it's the approach here that we tested. It wasn't so much that this species can grow around the continental U.S. It's that we should really be exploiting our own regionally native species to create lawns rather than importing them from overseas.
And if I use this particular approach to grass, I won't have to use a lot of water or pesticides or fertilizers.
Correct. What we were particularly interested in were things. One of the biggest resources is things like mowing. You know, we put about 500,000 gallons of gasoline into our mowers every year in the
wow.
U.S. So what we're saying, well, how can we reduce mowing? Well, these species actually grow quite slowly. And most of them are all evolved for low-nutrient soil. So you've got low mowing, and because they're adapted to low-nutrient situations, which you find out in nature, you don't have to fertilize these to the extent that we do our regular lawns.
It's a true green revolution. Mark Simmons is a research scientist at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center of the University of Texas at Austin. He joined us from his offices in Austin, Texas. And if you want to comment on that story or anything else you've heard, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You want to hear what you have to say.
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who'd like to mow less.
I'm golfing on ecologically responsible turf. I wonder if that's like a country club concept. Good morning. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, child abuse cases have been rising, but why? We're going to talk more about that in a few minutes. But right now, here's a check on some leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Iranian state television says Iran will agree to the general framework of a UN plan to ship enriched uranium out of the country to be processed, but the report says Iran will seek, quote, important changes in that deal.
Home prices were up in August for the third month in a row. The Case-Shiller Home Prices Index rose 1%, but home prices were still down from a year ago.
And here's a story we've been following since last week. New info released yesterday reveals that the pilots of Northwest Airlines Flight 188, which missed its destination, Minneapolis, by 150 miles, were using their personal laptops with their air traffic control headphones off, and that's apparently an FAA violation. Joining us for more is Patrick Smith, a commercial airline pilot. Patrick, laptops in the cockpit, is that normal?
No, it's not. And as I understand it, each airline has its own regulations as far as what is and isn't allowed during the cruise portion of flight.
And it seems like there are two big questions here, one that's significant regarding safety and the other that's significant just regarding airline passengers. Number one, if you have your headphones off and are distracted by a laptop, I mean, I'm assuming that the plane is relatively safe, but what's the worst-case scenario here besides overshooting a runway?
Well, first, John, it's not a violation to have your headsets off during the cruise portion of flight. That's very common. During takeoff and landing, approach and departure, you do have your headset on, but during the cruise portion of flight, it's perfectly normal to have the headset off using the hand microphone and the overhead cockpit speakers. Two things about this.
Wait one second, though. Does that mean it's okay to be out of contact with air traffic control?
No, those are entirely different
things. All right. Okay, good.
Two things about this incident in general, John. First, I have to say I'm a bit dismayed at the way the media has really hyper-analyzed this incident, looking for symptoms of it being some kind of a systemic breakdown, and I'm just not seeing that. To me, it was a freak occurrence. I mean, somebody did something wrong, but it was not a near catastrophe, and it was an aberration.
Okay, that's great, and that's fair, but just convince me that there's no worst case scenario here, that there couldn't have been a collision or there couldn't have been something worse.
It was very unlikely, and that's not to say that they did the right thing. Obviously, somebody dropped the ball here. The second thing I'd like to bring up, and this is important too, regardless of what the actual cause was, the incident has spun off a debate into pilot fatigue, because originally it was presumed by many people that the two pilots had fallen asleep.
Right.
I think this is important because it's a constructive conversation that we should be having, because pilot fatigue, while it's not a crisis, is something that needs to be looked at. Because the regulators have not been aggressive with
and it.
And it
probably will be looked at as a result of this. Finally, Patrick Smith, you know, I got to say, maybe it's just me, but the idea that two pilots have laptops in the cockpit and are checking schedules on presumably some kind of wireless, or maybe not.
Maybe
it's not wireless, but that really kind of puts the lie to the whole malarkey about turn off all your electronic devices on takeoff, doesn't it?
It may have been a violation of company or FAA rules as far as crew members using laptops during cruise flight, but it was not the takeoff or landing portion of the flight. It was during cruise flight, so no, not really.
All right, well, I had to ask you anyway. That's really true, though. It'll interfere with navigation? Really?
Potentially.
Potentially? Have you ever seen it?
No, I have not, but I've heard anecdotally of it happening, yes.
Patrick Smith, commercial air pilot and author of Ask the Pilot, the book, and the online column over at Salon.com. Thanks so much.
The latest federal figures are out, and they're not good news. They show that an estimated 1,760 U.S. children died from abuse and neglect in 2007. That's up 35% from 2001. What is leading to the spike in cases? People are wondering if it's a recession-related statistic. We're joined by Amy Terrera. She's a pediatric nurse practitioner who forensically diagnoses child abuse at the Phoenix Children's Hospital. Good morning, Amy. Can you tell me what you've seen? Have you seen an increase in child abuse cases at the Phoenix Children's Hospital?
We have seen an increase. We had seen the same amount of child abuse cases by mid-August of this year that we had seen during all of 2008.
And what kind of things are you seeing? When we say child abuse, that can include a lot of things.
It can include a lot of things. And when you're talking about kids who are being evaluated for child abuse at a children's hospital, primarily you're talking young kids, typically under the age of 3, who have been beaten so badly that their injuries require them to be hospitalized. So these are the worst of the worst. These are kids who have head injury, which a lot of people recognize the term shaken baby syndrome. So we've got kids with head injuries, abdominal injuries, and multiple broken bones.
Does it also include neglect? If a parent may say loses health insurance and can't treat their child's ear infection and then that ear infection begins to bleed, does that also come under the category of child abuse?
That would be considered medical neglect. That's not something that we would evaluate, but hopefully in a situation like that, because those situations absolutely do happen, they may lose their electricity, they don't have refrigeration, and their child's medications require refrigeration. So that could fall under medical neglect. Hopefully at that point they would get services to help them, because they're not that's not something they were doing intentionally. It's just a matter of the circumstances that they're in.
Well, therein lies a problem, since the services have been getting cut back during the recession. But we're joined also by Jim Murovich, president and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse America. It's a national organization that builds awareness about and attempts to prevent child abuse and neglect. He joins us from Indianapolis. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
So I assume that you read these sobering statistics and decided that it was time to really let the legislators know that it was time to stop child abuse. And although it's obviously nobody's going to disagree that we should prevent child abuse, The question is, how does one do that?
Well, I think there's actually solutions to be found. First of all, though, there really is no silver bullet, and that the healthy development of a child is certainly the role of a parent, but we've got to do this as an entire country, as an entire community. But to solve the problem, we must not only make people aware of the adverse impacts of abuse, we got to engage them in the solutions, and there's three of them, I think. First, I think we have to encourage our congressional leaders to support the continued inclusion of high-quality home visitation services and health care reform bills. And both chambers of Congress right now have that in it, and that's good. Second, when a child tragedy occurs, I think we must not only grieve the tragedy, we must press our public officials to ask the simple question, what service or what action could have been available to prevent the tragedy from ever occurring? And then we should press them to develop public policy that could modify whatever practice was in place. And last, as a nation, I think we have to make it a social and cultural norm that when child abuse and neglect occurs, we find it unacceptable, that parenting is a tough job, that it is good for a parent to ask for help and not feel embarrassed, ashamed, or stigmatized. And asking for help is not a sign of poor parenting.
I think that third one is the most difficult, Jim Murovich, because people often like to think that child abuse happens among them, other people. It's completely alien from their own situations, and yet we find that child abuse is not relegated to any one part of the population. Certainly it's not poor people or middle-class people. It happens in all kinds of families across the country. And how do we know if this is related to the recession? Is perhaps stress from unemployment? Is maybe they're in the house more often than they normally would be because a parent is unemployed now? Do we know if that is leading to a rise in child abuse cases?
Well, we don't have national data over the last 12 to 15 months, but I think intuitively, and certainly as we just heard in the prior comments, that it makes sense that child abuse and neglect has increased during these times because the research is clear. There's a clear relationship between stress and abuse. And as we all know, these are very stressful times for our families throughout the country. And you said something very important. This is not confined to people of lower social economic status. I was on a panel about a year ago, or not even a year ago, and one of the state welfare directors responded to the following question: have you seen an increase in abuse and neglect? His response was, yes, I have. And they said, in the center city. And he said, no, in the suburbs. For the first time, people are losing their homes, they're losing their jobs in the suburbs, and it's causing stress. And that's where we've been dedicating a lot of our resources.
And I think that's probably the takeaway. The recession is painful for everyone, but it's possibly hurting the most vulnerable in our population the most. That's children everywhere in America. Thanks to Jim Morovich, President and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse America. Also, Amy Terreros, pediatric nurse practitioner at Phoenix Children's Hospital.
And they got to be annoyed down at NASA. We've been watching all morning the launch of that new launch for the moon mission, but it's been delayed. They've been having weather problems all morning. But if you missed anything on the program, we are always on here at The Takeaway. You can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And there's an interesting narrative developing. People have been telling us our retraining stories, how they've changed careers and how difficult of a journey that was. We want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.